I have not seen, nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him, but God hath revealed them unto us by his Spirit. I like those words. They are not contradictory. I hath not seen does not deny the fact God hath revealed them to us by his Spirit. What these words tell us is that by our own comprehension, by our natural sight, by our natural thinking, we cannot possibly discern the things that God has prepared. But through the revelation of the Spirit, we may know the things that God has prepared for those who love him. Now I want to read some passages today so that we can begin to grasp some of those things that Revelation has recorded as being designed and prepared by God. Last week we thought a little while about the millennium and the revelation of Satanism in its logical termination. We realized that there would be multitudes outside the city as well as inside the city. Let's turn to Revelation 20 and carry on from where we were thinking last week. Verse 11 of Revelation 20, I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away. The great white throne cannot countenance sinful earth and heaven. That verse ends with, there was found no place. Jesus sits on his throne, and there is no place for sin. It always strikes me as being particularly poignant to realize that when Jesus came as a babe, no place was found for him either. Out in the cattle stall, no room for him. But when he comes a third time sitting on his great white throne, then there is no place for sin, or for sinners, or for this earth, or the atmospheric heavens around it that have been contaminated by sin. In verse 1 of chapter 21, John sees by the Spirit a new heaven and a new earth. A new earth. God made the earth to be inhabited by man. 4/5 of this earth at the present time can be only inhabited by fish. And so the Bible says there will be no more sea. See, this earth has been made for men, not fish. Only 1/5 of the mass of this surface is habitable by man. So in this new earth, there are not going to be great oceans or great seas. Cold, cruel, turbulent, unpredictable, death bringing to mankind. Why are there seas? Well, I think it's not difficult to surmise. The seas are our air conditioning plant. If it weren't for the seas, we'd either be cooked or frozen. If you think of the conditions in Labrador, in northern Canada, and then go across the map, Ireland and England and Denmark and Norway and Sweden would be like the tundras. But they have a heating plant known as the Gulf Stream that flows from warmer areas, and the warm currents go around Ireland and round the north of Scotland, just south of Iceland, and touch up against the Norwegian coasts and go down into the North Sea. That's why that area can be inhabited. It would be inhabited by polar bears if it weren't for the currents. We have currents that go up the coast here in the west that keep the northern parts and even southern Alaska habitable. If they weren't for the oceans, we would be cooked in some parts of the world. So God, seeing the changes that were brought about at the time of the flood, added water from above the firmament into this planet of ours. And of course that would raise the quantity of water and would shrink the shoreline. When the new earth is made, then I think the waters that were above the firmament will again be above the firmament as a sort of polarizing curtain around this planet to keep all parts of it the same even, pleasant, habitable temperature. So he sees a new atmospheric heaven. Went back to the condition it was in before it was fractured at the time of the flood. And the windows of heaven were opened, and all those waters above the firmament cascaded down to drown and wash this planet. So there is a new heaven, the same as it's described in Genesis 1. The waters above and the waters beneath the stretched out place, the rakia, the firmament. Then there are no more seas, no more great ocean areas. But the earth will be habitable. Every man under his vine and under his fig tree. Each man with his own separate property area. There will be no vast, tall, rugged, inhospitable mountain ranges. We don't have very high mountains in continental North America. But even to live 12 and 14,000 feet high can be a little difficult sometimes when the wind is blowing and the temperature in the wind, because of the evaporation factor, is way, way below zero. You go out and freeze. You can't sit under your vine and under your fig tree unless you're dressed like an Eskimo in an igloo. So that, of course, means that there will be no inhospitable mountains. I grew up living on a group of hills about 6,000-7,000 feet high. There were some special parts you could stand in the winter, January and February. And you could look north 200 miles. And you seem to look into a blue, blue, cloudy area. And then on really clear, crisp, cold days, you could see the jagged sawtooth of the Himalaya Mountains. Kanchenjunga, Dwalagiri, several peaks, 26, 27, 28,000 feet high. They seem to be floating in the air. The sun caught on them, their sparkling brilliance a couple hundred miles away. The valley in between, the hills, 26, 27,000, you could see them from hills 6,000 feet right across them. Nobody can live in those mountains. Too cold. Perpetual snows. Slowly moving, eroding glaciers. Sharp, ragged peaks. Winds that blow at velocities of 100 miles an hour. And God makes a new earth, all those turbulent waves of granite will sigh and sink into beautiful undulating hills with broad valleys and large plains with springing water, slowly gliding majestic rivers. All things will be made new, and this earth will be made habitable again. There will be inhabitants in that land that will grow up as calves in the stall. The leaves of the tree of life, we are told, are for the healing, and the word there is upbuilding, physiologically upbuilding of the nations. I like that statement in Spiritual Gifts, that Adam was more than twice as tall as men now living. All right, how tall would more than twice as tall as men now living? How tall are men now living? How tall is Wilt Chamberlain? 7 feet? There are men living more than that now. If they're inhabitants of the earth will be more than twice as tall as men now living, maybe they will be 16, 17, 18 feet tall. Now if you said to yourself, now you can do this, any mathematician here can do this. It'll sound fabulous, but it's factual. You work it out. If you get a man that is really physically perfect, Sugar Ray Robinson, for example, in his prime, 200-pound man, tough, all muscle and steel, and then say to yourself, how heavy would he be 17 feet tall? He would be 3,500 pounds. And if Eve came to his shoulder, he would be a cool ton and a half. Some of you ladies have got a little distance to grow before you weigh 3,000 pounds. That will be the natural weight. How fast can you walk now? 4 miles an hour? You will maybe be able to walk 25 miles an hour. Now, please don't take what I'm saying and just swallow it. Go home and use a slide rule and work all this out. It'll do your brain good as well as your soul good. And if you can't figure it out, go to a mathematician and let him do it too. I've tried this in the math and physics department and an anatomy department of several colleges. Imagine growing up. Some of us, 165 pounds, we've got to grow up to be 3,500 pounds. Tiny little sawed-off six-foot peewees. You've got a long way to go. See, some of the trees that are old trees are big trees. A man who weighs 3,500 pounds couldn't lean against any tree I've got in my garden. He couldn't even lean against that 2-foot, 3-foot pine tree I have up at Langwin. The thing would land on my neighbor's roof. He'd need that 17-foot diameter redwood that's just near the pulpit at Humboldt State Park where we have our camp meetings at Fortuna. Now he could lean up on that. He could almost touch some of the lower branches. See, the inhabitant is going to grow up like a calf in the stall, and his elder brother is going to be there who will be head and shoulders taller than his brethren. Now, they tell us that one's intelligence depends upon the surface of one's brain. Just imagine having a brain as big as the largest watermelon you've ever seen. What do our 125 IQs look like compared with that? See, they begin to reckon the dunces starting with 1,200. See, this is something that we've got to think through and see. The changes will be enormous. Enormous. And the inhabitant will not say, I am sick. There will be no more pain. There will be no more curse. Curse. Cursed shall the ground be for your sake. Curse is a frustration of blessing. It's the negation of blessing. It's the undoing of all the ongoing processes of God. And as Jesus told us in the parable of the wheat and the tares, an enemy hath done this. And he told the woman, part of the curse was her suffering. Sorrow shalt thou conceive, bear children. But every month, every inhabitant, the mystic woman, the church, will come up to the New Jerusalem and feast there unrestrained on the fruit and the leaves of the tree of life. Is that what Revelation 22 says? Verse 2, they shall eat every fruit in her month. The leaves of the trees are for the healing of the nation, and there'll be no more curse. See the connection? That which sin negated, that which sin eroded and finally destroyed, blessing of God will ultimately restore to its full measure of the stature of the perfect man and woman in Christ Jesus. There will be no more sorrow, no more crying. The former things will pass away and never be remembered. Memory is a very pleasant thing. Forgetting sometimes can be even more pleasant. There are many things we are glad to forget. And in the structure of our minds, God has given us the ability to forget. Some of us have that ability in more rich measure. But forgetting is part of the divine program. And all the things of time and all the things of sin will be forgotten. Never come into mind again. All the partings, all the dyings, all the hurtings, all the sorrows, all the anxieties, pass away forever, never be remembered. The occupation of that city and of that country. They will build houses and inhabit them. They will plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. They will not build and another inhabit. They will not plant and another eat. What does this mean? One's goals will be attained. There will be no jarring frustrations, no tragic negations of plans and purposes. There will be fulfillment and achievement. We all like to build all sorts of things. We like to make them. We like to plan them. We build institutions. We build families. We build companies, we build work associations. Sometimes we don't. For years I tried to build religion departments. When and it was my responsibility to call men and try to build a department. I used to pray and dream, now let's get somebody in that area who can teach this effectively. Somebody in that area so that you have a team that will accomplish something. You say to yourself, now this school year I've got it. And come December or January, one of them is whisked off somewhere else. You've got to begin again. Who are you going to get in here? And so I have found many, many frustrations. You hope to build a team to accomplish something. Just when you think you have it, there comes a splintering and splitting, and the purposes have got to be started again. But not in the new earth. They will build and eat the fruit of it. You will attain the goal and achieve the end. The animals will be friendly and beautiful. They will be loving, tolerant of each other. Nowadays, they're bringing different parts of this country outdoor zoos. Lions and zebras and hippos and rhinoceros, leopards and camels and horses, birds of various kinds. They got to keep them pretty well separate. Rivers, guards, fences, they're out in the open, but they must be kept from each other. There, lion will sit down with the calf. The wolf and the lamb will play together. A child will be able to stroke a rattlesnake. They will not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, saith the Lord. So the very nature of animals will change. There will be a complete roundabout face of every evil trait and every disposition to wrong. Not only of man, but of also all the creatures that God has made. You know, I think sometimes the moment Eve and Adam took that fruit and ate it in defiance of God's expressed word, a mosquito set on a rabbit's ear and dug its pointer right into him. The whole thing is shattered. The whole thing is shattered. Now, the whole thing is being put together again. There were no rainstorms, no eroding floods, no avalanches before, in the beginning. Dew came up from the ground, watered everything, gently, almost imperceptibly, soothingly. The back of our house here, I sometimes walk up in the hills. There are many narrow gorges, valleys, all water-worn. Sometimes torrential rains have come down and eroded them. Where they build, they make lateral drainage systems to prevent that erosion from going down and inundating the homes that are down below. The new earth? No. Nothing more. No high escarpments, no deep valleys, no inhospitable crags and cliffs. The dew will arise gently with the setting sun, and the whole land will be watered as in the garden of God. Just imagine the most beautiful place you have seen. I sometimes look into forests and see all the trees that need cleaning out. In 1930, the Seventh-day Adventists bought a mansion about 60 or 70 miles north of London, in the Midlands. In the county of Warwickshire, near the little village of Newbold, on the River Avon. Newbold-on-Avon is about 20 miles away from Stratford-on-Avon. The River Avon meanders through those almost flat fields. This home that they bought was mainly a Georgian mansion. They bought it for a college in 313 acres. This was 1930. 25 years before, the owners had spent about $10 million furbishing it, fixing it up. It had three lakes. It had many great fountains, something like the fountains at Versailles. It had beautiful doors made of Honduras mahogany, 3 inches thick. Periodically, the village polishers would spend 6 months polishing those doors. There were 28 gardeners. And then the taxes executed all possibility of one man maintaining it. The trees round it were beeches and elms and oaks. Every year the owner had had tree surgeons go right through those trees and take every dead limb out. He had a beautiful tiled courtyard with stables for about 20 horses that were air-conditioned. He had kennels for his hounds, maybe 75 or 100 of them, that were also air-conditioned. And the men who took care of his horses and his hounds all had homes roundabout close by so they could watch them. And we young students who went there looked at this place, and we had never seen anything like it. And from that time, as I'd wander through those spinneys and see, after we had it, of course, we didn't have any tree surgeons going through and spending hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars cleaning them out. Ends of branches died, leaves dropped off, trees are all the time dying. They've got to be cleaned, trimmed, pruned. In the new earth, everything will grow perfectly. They will not need that. They will be perfect in this beautiful land. This is the picture that the texts give to us of a restoration, of a reestablishment of that plan that God had in the Garden of Eden. And all man saw was Eden. The whole earth was to be as Eden, the garden of the Lord. Since then, we see desolation. In every continent, there are death valleys. In every continent, there are crags and mountain ranges, inhospitable, salty lands. But in the new earth, behold, all things are made new. Now let's look at the capital city of this new earth in Revelation Chapter 21. First of all, we are told that this city lieth four square. Its length and breadth and height of it are all equal, therefore it's a cube. Now, I know there are some folk who reason and say, well, the length and breadth and height of it are proportional, but you know, the Greek doesn't say that. The Greek says they're equal. And the reason why you think it's proportional, because 15,000 cubits, 12,000 furlongs rather, 12,000 furlongs, 3,000 furlongs to each side, makes it hundreds of miles high. This is the antitype of the most holy place, the length and breadth and height of which were all equal. They were perfect cubes. The most holy place in the tabernacle, and the most holy place in the temple, and the most holy place in the universe will be this New Jerusalem. And in the center of it will be the throne of God. And from it will stream the glory of God. And we are told this city has 12 gates. 3 to the north and 3 to the south, 3 to the east and 3 to the west. And on those gates are written the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. Each gate is a pearl. The city has 12 foundations. And on each of those foundations is written a name of one of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Now, Ellen White tells us that the stones of the breastplate were the same as the stones in the foundation of the New Jerusalem. Very interesting observation. Patriarchs and Prophets. In that chapter, what is the sanctuary? Or rather, it's the chapter on the tabernacle. That what is the sanctuary is in great controversy. Let's look at each of these items just briefly, one at a time. What is a pearl? What do we say a pearl was? Something precious? Made by a mollusk, whose name is Margaritifera vulgaris. Margarita, Margaret, is the Latin name for a pearl. And so, Margaritifera, ferra from ferry, I carry, I bear, ferro, it's the Margaret-bearing common mollusk, vulgaris. Margaret-bearing, Margaritifera, vulgaris. It's a mollusk bivalve, the center of the inside of which is covered with nacre, mother of pearl, stuff they make buttons out of, shirt buttons. If you go to Norfolk, Virginia, and places in Eastern Virginia, you can find pathways made of crushed shell from which they have punched out various diameter circles that they make into buttons. When they've punched out a certain number of circular ones, then you've got all the rims round them, like you get the plastic container of a six-pack, and they grind that up, make the pathways, nice white mother-of-pearl pathways to your house, a little crunchy. A little hard on bare feet, but they look very nice. Now, the inside wall of the mollusk, he lines it, wallpapers it, if you will, with this nacre. And every year, perhaps once, sometimes twice, he gives it another layer. And so his shell grows larger and larger from the inside. Starts out very tiny, maybe an eighth of an inch in diameter, when he comes out of the egg that is called a spat, and he floats, his specific gravity keeps him about 120 feet above, beneath the surface, so he floats on the current. He has little hairs called byssus hanging out of the hinge, and these attach to some rock and fixes there. And then he sleeps with his mouth open, which is always a dangerous thing to do. That's how he eats. That's how the plankton goes through, and he absorbs it and eats it. The water currents go right through. And as he grows, he lines the shell more and more and more and more, and so the part nearest the hinge is the oldest, and the mollusk shell gets larger and larger. Now, there are some people who think that the kernel of a pearl is a grain of sand. I once read a doctoral dissertation in which a fellow had worked on for a pearl fishery, worked on his doctor's degree in the Gulf of Mannar, that is between Ceylon and India, one of the finest pearl beds in the world. And he had dissected 13,000 pearls and never found a grain of sand in one. That's a myth. But what is in the nucleus of a shell, of a pearl, is a little sea creature called a cestode. Cestode, C-E-S-T-O-D-E. It's a tiny little worm-like creature whose favorite diet is oyster meat. And when he gets into a bed of mollusks, he tries to bore through the shell. He's got a sharp borer, and he can bore right through that calcite. Get inside. Now, once inside, if he can get himself and a few companions in, then they got it made. But if this mollusk wakes up to his danger, the mollusk is not without self-defense. He has a gland near the base that secretes a juice called, it's like keratin. It is keratin. The same stuff your hair and your fingernails are made of. And this keratin is squirted around this little cestode in the form of a net. It's amazing. It goes around him and he's caught inside a net, just like the old gladiators in Rome would try to throw a net over their enemies, and so while they were struggling there, they could stick their broadswords into them. Well, this mollusk tries to get that cestode inside a net of keratin. And when he has enclosed him, he's got another gland that excretes a juice, a substance called calcite, something like chalk. And this chalk, this juice, calcite juice, fills in the mesh, just like a soap that a child takes in a little plastic circle and puts it in a solution of soap to blow a bubble. You know how it forms a little film of soap? So this calcite forms a film within the meshes of the net. And that net has a mesh with six sides, just like the hive of a bee, hexagonal. And so inside this keratin mesh, lined with little thin tiles of calcite, this cestode is hemmed in. And then, as often as it wants to, the mollusk will throw another net around that little nucleus and put another layer of calcite and then another net and another layer of calcite and so on, just like the rings of an onion. It grows bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, nobody knows why it changes, but sometimes instead of laying down a tile of calcite, this gland of this mollusk will exude a substance a little different called aragonite. And this stands up like microscopic little matchsticks all over this nucleus. And then later, the whole thing will be enclosed in another keratin net and the tiles laid down in the interstices of the net by the gland that exudes calcite. Now, if you take a mother-of-pearl button, put it on a rock, hit it with a hammer, all you get is white powder. That's what calcite is, and that's what aragonite is. But if you take a pearl in your hand and twist it around, you'll see it's pearly, it's iridescent. It's got all the colors of the rainbow on it. It's like the iridescence of a smear of oil on a puddle in the street after a rainy day, or the iridescence on a pigeon's wing, a pigeon's neck, or a peacock's neck. Why is it that there is all this prismatic play of light? Well, these tiles, like the smear of oil on a slick, on a puddle, are very, very thin. And when the light falls on that smear of oil or on that layer of pearl, it's refracted, it's bent. It goes right through and it's reflected. It's bounced off the tile underneath. See, if I threw a tennis ball on the ground, the angle at which I threw it would be the exact angle at which it would bounce. But I throw it through air and the air doesn't bend it. The wind might bend it. But the going through of the light, the ray of light, through this little tile of calcite, bends it. Then it hits the underside where there's another tile. It's bounced off it. As it comes through, it's bent again. And then it springs through the surface, 186,000 miles a second. And as it comes through, it's broken up, just like a prism breaks up the rays of light. And so when you look at it, it's got all the colors of the rainbow on it. There is nothing intrinsic about a pearl that colors it. But it's the way it refracts light that enables it to show all the colors of the rainbow. Now, the longer the mollusk lives, the bigger the pearl gets. Now, if it spends all its energy, all its keratin, all its calcite, all its aragonite to build a pearl, it doesn't build a big shell. And so those who fish for pearls never go for a big, huge pearl. It's used all its substance to build its own house. But if it's got a tiny little wizened old twisted shell, chances are that it's busy making a jewel inside. The enemy that would have destroyed the mollusk becomes then the nucleus of a pearl of great price. Learn from yon orient shell to love thy foe and wish him well that would thee woe. Persian by a poet said long ago, that which brings woe upon you, you can by proper usage make into a jewel. That blow that was aimed at the heart of the mollusk became the pearl of great price. That spear thrust that entered the heart of Jesus Christ opened a new and living way into the holiest of all. So every gate that is an opening into the throne of God, into the city of God, is a pearl. A pearl of great price. The kingdom of heaven are like men and women seeking goodly pearls. There are 12 in number. And on each pearl is the name of a tribe. It would be fun to analyze each of those 12 tribes. Why don't you do it sometime? Get your concordance, or get Lockyer's book called All the Men of the Bible. Lockyer. L-O-C-K-Y-E-R. All the Men of the Bible. He's got all the texts for all the men of the Bible all together. Look up each of the 12 tribes. And when you have looked up all the texts describing them, you form a thumbnail sketch of the sort of people they are. When I say Benjamin, what do you think of? What sort of a person is Benjamin? Saul of Tarsus? The Bible calls him a wolf. Ravening as a wolf on his way to Damascus. Nobody to capture. Everyone thrown into prison. Many of them murdered in Jerusalem, going to Damascus to get some more. Benjamin, a wolf. Gad. When I say Gad, what sort of a picture flashes into your mind? I can see Gad with his elbow on a bar, his foot up, tankard of ale in front of him, slapping his thigh, telling jokes, surrounded by 6 or 8 of his buddies doing the same thing. That's Gad. Naphtali? Maybe I'm a little hard on him. But every time I think of Naphtali, I think of a man with lace round the edge of his pants, smelling of perfume, with fingernails 5 inches long. Maybe I'm wrong. You read all the texts and you see whether my my estimate is correct. When I think of Reuben, when his dad was out, Reuben raped his mother. And Levi? Remember what he did to the Shechemites? When he had killed them all, he went to their fields and he cut the tendons and the back legs of the oxen. He hocked the oxen. That's what Jacob said. So when you look at those 12 gates and see those men, you see a cross-section of humanity. A bunch of crooks. And their names on those pearly gates are invitations for those who are like them. Come on through. A new and living way has been found by which you can enter the city of God. Takes all kinds. How many people have sinned in the world? Oh, this is a picture of them. What God is trying to tell us, that no one need to be excluded. Are you that kind of man? Are you that kind of woman? Well, you can find your blood brothers in those 12 tribes. They're just like you. They did everything you're doing. And you did everything they're doing. But that doesn't mean you can be excluded. That's the whole point of the plan of salvation. Jesus did not come to call righteous. He came to call sinners. And we've all sinned and come short of the glory of God. And so what God is holding up before us is an invitation and a hope. Come on in. Come on in. The natural man. The 12 tribes, the 12 gates, through the wound that would have destroyed the Savior into the holiest. And the foundation, the 12 apostles, the spiritual men of the spiritual kingdom, sitting on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. They had encountered Christ. They were chained. The difference between the natural man and the spiritual man is a cross. That's the dividing of the way. And of the 12, Jesus could say, "You have been with me from the beginning." Changed, transformed, the metamorphosis complete, the foundation of the city. You can come in. The invitation is a natural man. But to remain in, there must be a spiritual man. And so there are 12 tribes, and there are 12 apostles, and there are 12 pearly gates, each gate a wound, each gate a memorial to a stab thrust to the heart of the Son of God. Very valuable. Pearl of great price. Look for it. Find it. Enter through it to the presence of God. And somewhere in the mystic glory of this city is the throne of God. To him that overcometh, I will grant to sit with me upon my throne. Not one man, not three or four or five or six particular friends, but to every overcomer. To every overcomer. He'll share the oval room. He'll share the chair behind the oval desk. Not ashamed to call us brethren. And yet he's our Lord. What a picture he gives of what he has prepared. Of how much he has prepared. And today we are still in this old world of sin and temptation. We won't be here very long. Not very long. Is that transformation taking place? We look up at those 12 gates and we see the natural man. We see ourselves. We're that. Liars and thieves and cheats and lechers and cruel and cussing and joking and laughing and playing. Proud and selfish and foolish. We're it all. But have we encountered the Christ and allowed him to change us, to transform us? Now that parable of the merchantman seeking pearls, as you study it, you discover it's two angles. So says Christ Object Lessons. It's first, Christ looking for us. Then, it's we looking for Christ. Sometimes we are like those animals, those sea creatures that would destroy the mollusk. Sometimes, like that centurion, we take the hands of Christ and nail them to a tree. And then hear him say, "Father, forgive. He doesn't know what he's doing." And before the day is done, we are changed into his child. And that which would have destroyed him becomes a jewel he carries on his forehead forever. Jesus looking for us, who would destroy him, is ready to change us into jewels that he's going to find when he comes a second time. He's going to make up his jewels. We don't play with it very many times, but if you like to look, you can see beautifully arranged pearl necklaces, starting with very evenly formed seed pearls at the back of the neck, and in pairs growing larger and larger and larger, perfectly balanced, perfectly consorted as for color. Jesus is wanting to make us up into a perfect gem, balanced, beautiful, each showing to best advantage the quality of the next. You know, there's something interesting about pearls. You put them in a box and they lose their luster. You keep them close to your heart and they glow. Jesus is looking for pearls that he wants to keep closest to his heart forever. A pearl is just white powder when you break it up. But its beauty lies in the way it can take light and break it up. Reflect it, refract it, show it off in all its colors. Jesus wants us, each in our own character, to let our light shine with any radiance that our experience can give. I know a lady up in Angwin. She used to teach nursing here in Glendale 25 years ago. She suffers from MS, and we've watched her through the years till now she can hardly move even her lips. Slightly she can move her head. Every time I go to see her, I am sure I am more blessed than she is. Her patience, her uncomplaining, letting her lot touch her as it comes is a lesson to me. She lets some light shine. And then I see young people come back from stints at mission fields, a year or two, bouncing and exuberant. They're letting their light shine in their way. Everyone must reflect the rays of the light of the Sun of Righteousness to the best advantage of their experience. Jesus is looking for that. That cumulative glow of the jewels that he will gather to himself forever. And the city has walls garnished with precious stones, reds that speak of blood, blues that tell of the law of God and heavenly obedience, gold that speak of faith and love, and silver that whispers of perfect adherence to the law of God. And the street of that city is paved with gold. Every step you take is a golden step. And to the indifferent at Laodicea, Jesus says, I counsel thee to buy of me gold, faith that works by love and purifies the soul. The inhabitant of that land will walk a golden road of faith, motivated by the purest love. And every road and every pathway will lead to him that is altogether lovely upon his throne. And tonight, he that sitteth on the throne says, Come. And the Spirit says, Come. And the true bride, the true church, says to its friends and strangers, Come. And whosoever will, let him come. And eat and drink freely forever. Let's pray. Eternal Father, again we thank thee that while I cannot see and mind cannot conceive, yet in thy condescension thou hast revealed much by thy Spirit. And we can see through a glass darkly and long for the day when we shall see face to face. We can pray to thee with stammering tongues and ignorant minds, but we long to talk with thee face to face. Accept us, Lord, change us, spiritualize us. Make us like Jesus. We ask in his wonderful name. Amen.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.